welcome everyone to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded.
Okay, well, with that, Dr. Gore, if you want to begin with Measure 389, and if we have the lines for the AMA PCPI folks open, we can go ahead.
Okay, so Measure 389 is a measure that is currently part of the PQRS, and it's looking at overuse of bone scan for patients with low-risk prostate cancer. So low-risk prostate cancer is defined by the patient's PSA, their Gleason score, and their clinical exam. The measure looks at the proportion of patients who did not have a bone scan at any time since their diagnosis of prostate cancer. In terms of importance of the measure, prostate cancer, you know, clearly is an important condition, highly prevalent incidence of something like 200,000 patients per year. A measure related to overuse of imaging, I think, is also important given the cost of excessive imaging studies and the value that we think bone scans have in these low-risk patients. The evidence presented justifying the measure is all low-level evidence. It's mostly administrative data and single institution data about the utility of bone scan in low-risk patients, where the likelihood of having a positive bone scan in these patients is far less than 1%. But the measure appears to have at least strong face validity when looking at an expert panel and their consideration of the measure. It seems to be very reliably assessed according to data that the PCPI submitted from its use in PQRS, it seems to be a highly usable measure. So I put yes for approval of the measure. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into about the measure itself or concerns about the measure.
Please, if you have any concerns, go ahead and raise them, and we'll have discussion about them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main concerns are that the evidence underlying it is weak, but frankly, I don't know that that's important for this measure. I don't know that it would be important to generate new evidence for bone scan, because every study that I've seen looking at use of bone scan in low-risk patients demonstrates non-utility. So it doesn't seem like it's a clinical question. It seems like something that has been consistently demonstrated not to be useful in low-risk prostate cancer. In terms of how it's measured and how usable the measure is, the only thing that I was surprised by was how poor compliance with the measure was, because my initial impression might be that it's a measure that already has very high adherence, so continuing as a measure may not be that high yield, but data from the PCPI suggests that it's actually that compliance is concerningly low. I don't know how important the issue of disparities are for this, but there's not a lot of data on disparities in either underuse or overuse of bone scans in general in prostate cancer. There is a lot of evidence on disparities in stage at presentation and mortality in prostate cancer, but this measure doesn't really have anything to do with that.
Okay. Well, at this point, would the rest of the work group members like to present their concerns or questions?
This is Jared. I guess both as a prostate cancer patient as well as a measurement expert here at the Joint Commission, and I have spoken to this issue on a call before, but I'm a guy that had a PSA of 1.29 and in just over a year had a PSA of 535 with a positive bone scan and a Gleason 8. In fact, my bone scan was done before my biopsy. I literally went from the urologist's office down to get my bone scan, and it was horrifically positive. So I guess I cringe at the notion of underuse of a bone scan, for the personal view here, but I sort of cringe at it, and I would urge that this is a measure that is important. I'm not sure about this whole notion underuse versus overuse versus misuse, but sometimes people are the exception rather than the rule.
I would agree, but you know, I think that you know, that is a glaring exception. And when you had your bone scan done, you had a PSA over 500, and so no one would question the utility of a bone scan in that circumstance.
Absolutely, I totally agree.
This is Elizabeth Hammond. I'm worried about the low prevalence of the problem. It sounds like this measure, if the prevalence of this measurement is, or the prevalence in low-risk patients is 1%, then is this a meaningful measure for us to be endorsing?
No.
The overuse is much more than 1%.
Yeah. The overuse is at least 25% in different series, and as high as 35% to 40%.
Okay.
The issue of positivity of a bone scan in low-risk prostate cancer is that the rate of positivity of a bone scan is far less than 1%. But
okay.
The prevalence of overuse of a bone scan is quite high.
All right. Good.
Okay, any other questions or discussion on this one?
Are there any questions for the developer?
It's Jared. One more quick time. I don't argue with the comments just made about prevalence of overuse, but we didn't note it in the write-up. It probably belongs there, but it isn't there.
Yeah, I think there definitely needs to be more evidence. The main article that's cited for overuse, prevalence of overuse, is an article from VA data, and that cites an overuse rate of 25% and a percent positivity of bone scans in low-risk prostate cancer of 0%.
This is Steve Edge. Has anybody done this in Sierra Medicare? It would be relatively easy to do.
Yeah. The problem with SEER Medicare is that PSA wasn't included in SEER just until 2004, and so it's only with the most recent iteration of SEER Medicare that it could be looked at with the specific designations of low risk used in the measure. So someone could look at it now.
Yeah, well, that would probably be very useful, and anybody who's got the data, this would not be a hard one to look at.
At all.
Oh, no. I think.
And Jared's comments are very appropriate, but it is. You know, if we back away from this, you know, there's a lot of literature in breast cancer and colon cancer and others that, you know, routine screening has no impact on outcome. It is a real thorny issue to the individual person who has something found on a scan. And, well, I talk about this every day with my patients.
I mean, it really comes down to, you know, we all believe in population health, but at the end of the day, patient-centered care requires treating an individual. And
yeah. So, Jared, I'm gonna challenge you a little bit, and I'm sorry to take the personal issue with you.
No, go ahead.
Was yours wasn't really, you didn't have a, you would not have fallen under this measure.
No.
Somebody
measured your PSA, you had a PSA of 500, and you appropriately were sent for a bone scan.
Right. I was sent for a bone scan the same day and had my biopsy next day.
Right.
But you would not have fallen as an overuse under this measure. You would have fallen as an appropriate use because you were not a low risk prostate patient.
Yep.
When you had that PSA of 500.
Totally agree with you.
Yeah, the other way to frame this is there's a large fraction of those unneeded bone scans that had red herrings found on them that turned out to be degenerative disease.
Yeah.
That got the patient anxious, maybe underwent an unnecessary biopsy, et cetera.
Or had
subsequent. This is obviously the big issue with these scanning studies is the false positive rate. And since I do breast cancer, breast MRI is just an enormous problem for us right now. But when you look at the individual patient who has the lesion found because they had an unnecessary breast MRI or an unnecessary prostate bone scan, it's hard to look them in the eye and tell them their scan was unnecessary.
Right.
Hear, hear.
We all live with it.
So Some more than others.
Yes.
All right.
Was there any estimate of the cost saving of the cost of applying this measure versus the cost savings? I mean, we talk about high cost studies, but in reality, a bone scan is not terribly expensive given the overall cost of treating prostate cancer.
Is there anyone from AMA PCPI on the line who can speak to that?
Hi, this is Deirdre from the AMA. We did not include any cost savings data, but that's something that I can certainly take a look at within the literature and see if I can get that to you.
And their earlier comment about the Medicare data, would that be something you'd be able to provide too?
I can check with our measure analytics staff and see if we have access to that particular data, and I can also include that if we have access to it.
I'm not sure you need to hold this up, but I think moving forward, this is something that could easily be tested in SEER Medicare and advise future iterations of this measure. While I say it would be easy, I understand that the person who actually does the work is not quite as easy as I said.
Yeah, but it would not be a study that would require a lot of labor-intensive programming, for sure.
Then generally looking across the rest of the survey results, everything was rated moderate to high. So if there are any points of discussion that you all want to raise, feel free. But from our end, there's nothing that we need to call out specifically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Dr. Gore, I believe you had the second measure, 390 prostate cancer adjuvant hormonal therapy for high-risk patients, also an AMA PCPI measure.
Sorry, one second. So this is likewise a measure that has been adopted and measured within PQRS. The measure relates to the percentage of patients with a diagnosis now on the other side of the spectrum of high-risk prostate cancer based on their PSA, their Gleason score, and their clinical exam, who are receiving external beam radiotherapy to the prostate, who concurrent with their external beam therapy were given hormone treatment. In terms of the importance of the measure, similar to the previous measure, prostate cancer is a highly prevalent cancer. In terms of initial treatment of curative intent, anywhere between 30 and 40% of patients in most series get external beam radiation therapy as their initial treatment. So this measure at least deals with a reasonable percentage of patients. Now, of those patients, the proportion that have high-risk prostate cancer at presentation is fairly low relatively, but low in the context of prostate cancer still is a substantial number of patients. In terms of the evidence underlying hormone therapy associated with external beam radiation for high-risk prostate cancer, this is mostly evidence derived from randomized controlled trials. So this is not expert opinion or based on single institution studies. This is higher level evidence. They didn't go into detail on a lot of the studies that are the underpinnings of this measure, but there have been several clinical trials looking at adjuvant hormone therapy for intermediate and high-risk prostate cancer, and they've very consistently shown a benefit. In terms of reliability and feasibility, the measure has fairly consistent reliability in terms of ascertainment. In terms of feasibility and usability, it seems to be fairly consistent. I was actually quite surprised that the initial PQRS data demonstrated fairly substantial non-adherence to the measure, although that data is from 2008. So more contemporary data may show higher compliance with the measure. In terms of concerns, I mean, it seems like this is a fairly reliably ascertained measure in terms of how the data is generated, in terms of its validity. That validity is derived both from RCT evidence as well as from high approval ratings from a panel that approved the measure. And so I said that this measure should, again, be approved.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Gorin. Thanks for taking on two measures, by the way. Are there any additional comments that you had or concerns for the developer?
You give me two fairly easy ones.
Okay. No? All right. For the rest of the work group, comments or discussion or concerns about the measure?
I thought this was one of the better ones.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, there's great data supporting it, and yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the only thing that I can think of is just that the high-risk population of people with localized prostate cancer at presentation is not a huge proportion, but still, in the context of a very large denominator, the numbers are probably substantial.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, if there are no other comments, we can move on.
That was easy.
Okay, great. Good measure. Next on our agenda is 382, the oncology measure, radiation dose limits to normal tissues. Dr. Mark was our lead discussant for this measure.
Okay, that's me. Thank you. We'll pull out. So external beam radiation is given often to patients with these cancers. Yeah, there's pancreas and lung, and it's considered basically standard of care to set dose constraints for the normal tissues before you initiate therapy. So this is a very bread and butter sort of metric. There's a high impact. The opportunity for improvement is where this falls down. I would have guessed this would have had, you know, a 90-plus percent adherence rate, maybe 95%. You almost can't do your job. You can't sign a prescription without looking at the lung doses or the kidney doses. And the idea that you wouldn't do this before you treated somebody, it is malpractice. And indeed, they do report a compliance rate of 89.42%. And they write, the mean performance was 89%, showing an opportunity for improvement. I don't know if a 10% gap, and I'm willing to bet that 10% was just, you know, poor documentation of what was actually done. So that's where this falls down. The opportunity for improvement, I think, is low. It is a reasonably valid measure. There's reasonable data relating the doses to the lung and the kidneys and the liver to the outcome of the patient. So it's an important thing to monitor and to look at. One could relatively get this relatively quickly out of most treatment planning systems, so it's pretty reliable. It's available electronically, so again, it's relatively reliable and valid. My main concern, again, is there's no data on disparities of care, just looking through this. Is it useful for public reporting? I wouldn't think so. This is sort of hard to explain to the public, I think, because it's a pretty technical sort of point. It is generated as a byproduct of usual care. It's available electronically. So overall, I guess it's suitable if a 10% detriment in current performance is deemed to be worthy enough of having this measure. So I think it's a reasonable thing to measure. I don't know what the gold standard is. Is 89% compliance presently considered high enough to say we shouldn't be measuring this metric? And that answer I don't have for the group. So overall, I think I posed that question to the NQF staff, what the right threshold is for upside potential, if you would.
Well, actually, we would throw it open to the rest of the experts here on the work group to discuss that potential aspect of it.
Okay.
And did you have an overall recommendation for this one?
Yeah, overall, I think it's a reasonable thing to measure. Again, I suspect that it's being done very close to 100% of the time now.
Okay.
And the fact that the data says it's 90% of the time, I think 10% of the time it just wasn't coded properly or the patient was treated emergently. So when you do something emergently, you don't have the dose constraints set. So that would be my main concern. Maybe the people who propose this are on the line and could comment about the 89% number.
Is there someone, AMA PCPI, there that could discuss this?
Yeah, hi, this is Sam Tierney with the AMA PCPI. You know, unfortunately, the only date we weren't able to find any data from the literature to support the opportunity for improvement, and the only data we have is from the use of this measure in the PQRS program. And the mean performance rate is 89.42, as you said, but unfortunately, they did not provide data regarding variability, and we have seen, at least with other measures in the PQRS program where variability is reported, you know, significant opportunity for improvement based on the variability, the range across practices. But that information wasn't available for this measure. We could certainly try to do some more research to see if we could get any additional information to document a gap in care opportunity for improvement. But unfortunately, all we had available to us at this point is the PQRS data.
Okay.
Hey, this is Pat Ross from Ohio State. So I understand your concern about is a 10 or 11% improvement enough, but I question whether or not you're being naive in assuming that it's being done in those 11% of the patients. It seems to me that from what you said, if it isn't done, it's malpractice. That's how you started the discussion.
Yeah,
so,
I agree. Yeah.
So 11% of the patients being treated then are being treated at a level that you would describe as malpractice. Am I interpreting your?
Well, unless they were treated emergently or with palliative intent very quickly, something like that. So, you know, for the typical curative case, it should be 100% or it's malpractice. Yes,
right.
So
really what you're describing is a never event, right? You should never not have done this calculation. Am I right?
That's correct.
So I think it's a valid measure then.
I guess the only time you would never do it, you might do it if you knew intuitively that your field was acceptable. They'll say you had a small lung cancer in the apex of the lung and you put a small radiation field on. You know from your years of experience that the dose constraint for the lung is going to be met. And
yeah, but I think that's why we're trying to develop metrics, right, to get away from intuition. I mean, I don't agree with that.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, again, I think it's a reasonable thing. It's never, zero is a very small number. You know, it's true. You know, when
Larry,
what's
the impact on outcome if one doesn't do this?
Your risk of, well, so in the lung, your risk of pneumonitis is very well related to the mean lung dose, for example, or the lung dose volumes. So you always have to look at the lung dose volumes before you sign your prescription to make sure that you're not going to kill the patient or put them at too high a risk of radiation pneumonitis. So the downside is a risk of a complication. It's not a certainty of a complication, but it's a risk. So, you know, we all have these sort of guidelines that we go by of how much lung can we take to 2,000 to 3,000 or 4,000 rad before we put the patient at an undue risk of pneumonitis. The only other, if you had a peripheral lung lesion, the only organ is really the lung. So this business, they do say they want a minimum of two sites. If you're doing conformal radiation on a peripheral lung lesion, and again, I know it's intuition, but you know you're not near the esophagus, right? The tumor is 10 centimeters from the esophagus, and you're 10 centimeters from the spinal cord. So I don't even really need to measure the dose to those areas. We do it because, you know, it's part of our compulsive nature, but if I didn't draw the spinal cord or the esophagus and a peripheral lung lesion, I don't know if I'd be guilty of malpractice in that setting. But for the typical stage 3 lung patient, it would be malpractice. So maybe clarification, maybe stage 3 lung patients for two organs. Certainly one organ in every patient. You know, the lung should be specified in every patient what the dose is to the lung before you treat the patient.
That seems to make sense.
Yeah. And for the abdomen, you treat the pancreas, you always have to worry about the liver and the kidneys. So there you get two organs for the pancreas. Now, do the people who promoted this, who suggested this, what do they think about one organ as opposed to two organs to get us away from this challenge of the lung?
This is Sam Tierney with the AMA PCPI again. That's something we could take back to our clinical experts and see. I'm not exactly sure why two was selected, but we could certainly take that question back and see, the example you provided, for instance, and see what the thinking was behind the two tissues just to provide some more information and clarification.
Right. But again, it's a reasonable metric. It is quantitative. It's relatively easy to gather, I think.
Okay. Any other discussion on this one? And it sounds like we have a question that the developer is going to take back to their experts. Okay, then that's the end of discussion for now on 382. Our next one is 388, prostate cancer, three-dimensional radiotherapy, and I have Dr. Ricciardi as the lead discussant for that one, also
yes,
an AMA
you.
Measure.
Thank you. This is, it looks like it's up for endorsement maintenance review. It was
right.
Originally endorsed in July of 2008.
Correct.
In brief, it is a process measure evaluating use of three-dimensional radiotherapy for clinically localized prostate cancer receiving external beam radiotherapy as primary therapy. I looking through this, there are no denominator exclusions that I noted. Data aggregation is for all ages and all patients with clinically localized prostate cancer receiving radiation as primary therapy. And when I, as someone who looks at this stuff, my question would be then how the denominator is aggregated, if it's an electronic medical record or administrative data, are they able to exclude recurrent prostate cancers and confirm that it is primary therapy? They don't mention how far back they would look through electronic record or the administrative data to exclude those patients who've had recurrences or how they identify that this is actually a localized tumor. Based on the ICD-9 codes they've provided, they certainly can't determine that. The measure does directly address a specific national health goal, so I graded this as high. There's certainly opportunity for improvement reading their text. Only 49.2% or 49.9% meet the actual measure in the past, in 2008, I think, was the year that they gave us. So there certainly is room for improvement. Although it's not a health outcome, I did mention it's a process measure. The data do come from fairly good sources, retrospective data, population-based studies, and meta-analyses, as well as consensus guidelines. Again, with respect to reliability and validity, my concern is just the chart abstraction or the electronic medical record abstraction, and how we are able to exclude the recurrent tumors, the non-locally advanced tumors, and I'm not a prostate cancer specialist by any means, but certainly brachytherapy is a fairly useful tool for these patients, and I'm not sure if those are excluded because it is focusing on external beam radiation alone. Maybe someone from the AMA can comment on that. There's no contradictory evidence that I can identify. The studies are fairly concordant, and it certainly is a usable measure, and it is feasible. The authors have shown that. But again, my concerns would be potential inaccuracies in coding locally advanced, in coding metastatic disease, or patients who are having adjuvant therapy for radiation. Those are my concerns. Otherwise, I think this is a very good measure.
Sam or Deidre, do you have anything to add in response to that?
Yeah, thank you. We can appreciate the question. And currently, for use in administrative claims data, We have a CPT-2 code that would be required to identify a patient for eligibility for this measure, and it's code, it should be included in the submission information, it's code 4200F, which indicates external beam radiotherapy as primary therapy to the prostate with or without nodal irradiation. So someone reporting on this measure in PQRS, for example, would have to also include that code to indicate that the patient was eligible for this measure.
So would proton beam radiation be an exclusion for consideration for the measure?
It's a great question.
That is a great question.
Yeah, it wouldn't, as it's written, it just says external beam radiotherapy, so it would be included.
Is there a specific extra CPT code for proton beam?
There is not. There is one CPT-2 code, just for your information, that would indicate the patient was not eligible for this measure, and that's code 4201F, and that would be required in a program like the PQRS program that's just done through claims reporting only. And just to offer for your information, the code descriptor for that measure says external beam radiotherapy with or without nodal irradiation as adjuvant or salvage therapy for prostate cancer patients. So it doesn't specify anything about proton beam radiation as you're questioning.
So basically, if you did proton beam, you would have to just put an exclusion code on.
Right.
They are all getting three-dimensional conformal therapy with protons.
Yeah. Or should it just be folded into the measure? So percentage of patients who receive 3D, IMRT, or proton beam.
Yeah, I don't even know if you need the clarification, because proton is just a subtype of 3D conformal.
Yeah, so then rather than say 3D or IMRT, should it say who have three-dimensional planning or something?
Yeah, because IMRT is three-dimensional planning also. I never quite understood the nomenclature there.
Yeah.
There's also one where the expected rate should be 100%.
Yeah.
Sam, is this something that you would be able to take back to your committee?
Yeah, certainly. We could get some clarification regarding proton beam radiation. In particular, you know, maybe some more information about the use of the CPT-2 codes for this to exclude patients who shouldn't be included in the denominator.
Okay. All right. Are there any other discussion about this one? Anything else we might want to get clarified? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ricciardi. And we'll move on to Jared Loeb, 0625, History of Prostate Cancer Surveillance by Active Health.
Thank you very much. Let me start by wondering if anyone from Active Health Management is on the phone.
Danielle, can you check that, please? And if they are, can you open their line?
Absolutely. And if you are with that company, please press *0 at this time.
Something's on fire somewhere. Well, while we wait, should I go on?
And what was the company name one more time?
Active Health Management. That's the measure steward.
And it appears we do not have anybody on the line from that company.
Well, let me start then by talking a little about Active Health Management, because I was not aware of who they were. So I did a little bit of my own investigation, and it turns out they're a wholly branded standalone business that's been owned by Aetna since 2005, and they focus on population health. And much of their website is devoted to disease management, particularly with respect to cost savings clinical decision support and something they obviously have as a proprietary piece called a care engine system. So a lot of this is a black box that is a little difficult for one to open, which was troublesome to begin with. So let's talk about the measure itself. From a relevance perspective, the numerator and denominator make perfectly intuitive sense. And as I said before, as a guy that's been dealing with prostate cancer myself for the last 7 months, I find it absolutely astounding that there would actually be a numerator that says men who had at least one PSA level in the past 12 months who have been under, with the denominator being men with localized prostate cancer who have been under treatment with curative intent. And later on in their write-up, I will tell you quite personally, it makes me sick that their data show that in 2011, 20% of men identified by this measure indeed did not have recommended follow-up PSAs. If that is indeed the case, that is a strong piece of evidence in support of a huge gap and a reason for the measure. That's the good news. The bad news is I do not believe, and I will apologize for having checked the yes box at the end here, suggesting that the measure is in fact suitable to move forward, because I in fact believe quite the opposite and reviewed it all over the weekend again and this morning yet again to verify that my initial inclination, which was sort of spotty based on some good things and some bad things about the measure, I was driven in part by that gap that I identified a few moments ago, suggesting to me that we really do need a measure. But the more I've looked at this measure, the more I believe strongly, in contrast to what's listed at the end of my SurveyMonkey, that this is not the right measure. And I'll give you a couple of reasons, not the least of which is, as best I can tell from the write-up, they've got a huge database. Indeed, they talk about 20 million patient records in the database. But interestingly enough, the average age of the population is 37, 51% of which is in fact female, and they tested the measure in their database. They talk about 279,966 patients from a major health plan, assuming that's an Aetna plan. The average age of that population was 35, and 52% were female. They did that data abstraction just last year, but that's in fact the only test data that I was able to note in here, and that test data raises my eyebrows as to whether the population cohort is in fact sufficient to really feel comfortable that this measure has been tested adequately. The rationale for denominator exclusions here, and that's really right on page one, there are eight different exclusions, some of which once again would raise my eyebrows. So, for example, a patient admitted to a skilled nursing facility in the past 3 months, de novo, why would one wish to exclude that patient if the patient is in a SNF? I don't really see that. There's a few others that are in denominator exclusions that make me wonder. The reason I'm somewhat walking a fence here is because I really think we need a measure that addresses this issue if, in fact, the data regarding the notion that 20% of patients that are being treated for prostate cancer do not have follow-up PSA in 12 months. If that's true, we need a measure. But my argument is this is not the measure. I do not believe that it has the science behind it in the context of reliability testing, and I would not recommend the measure go forward.